Chapter 13.
Not a normal lictor was God's favourite euphemism. Your assigned brothers and sisters favoured different terms. The saint of patience quite liked diet lictor. You sometimes planned Augustine's death, and you did not make it quick. But you found chilly comfort in being within a range of normality, rather than on the wrong side of a binary. Within that range was also Ianthe the First. On that same night, after you came back safely to the arms of the Mithraeum, you found her sat in the tawdry quarters of her forebear, glumly eating soup. Her exquisite Canaanite robe hung from a peg. You noticed that the hem was muddy, and she was wearing one of the ridiculous skirts and shirtwaists she had unearthed from the wardrobe, all of which had Valency carefully embroidered on the inside seams. The skirts and waists were all beautifully cut for someone of a different height and body type than Ianthe possessed. They were tight where they should have been loose, and loose where they should have been tight. They looked like her burial clothes, and she looked as though she had emerged 50 years after that burial. This particular garment, a deep spinel-tinged satin, exposed one shoulder entirely, and it was the shoulder of what you had come to think of as the arm. The right arm that Kithareia the First had removed just above the elbow, with somebody else's reattached wholesale. The new limb hung heavy from its olecranal point with a bluish seam. It looked fat and swollen and unused, which was ridiculous, because you had never been able to see anything wrong with it. It had been very nicely matched to the original, until she had ceased using it altogether, and the difference was more pronounced each day. Unconscious of your critical eye, she scratched fretfully at the line until red hives appeared.
1510, said your sister Lictor, as soon as she noticed you.
You said,
834.
And she said, "My God, hark at the creature.
834, and such a dreadful pity that it doesn't even matter."
She was in a filthy mood if she was wearing that thing with her arm exposed. You were not in the best frame of mind yourself.
"Let us interrogate," you said. "Does it not matter? Because despite cutting 3 whole minutes off your previous time, you could never hope to challenge me in this arena. Or does it not matter because I'm going to die to number 7?
"You're being damned optimistic if you think you'll live to see number 7, she said, blue-eyed, those oily little freckles glittering almost pinkly above the dress. They reflected the red rims of her eyelids. You thought that she had been crying. "I'm amazed you made it here from the docking bay without getting assassinated, Harry."
"I will not answer to that sobriquet.
Close the door and I'll call you Nona Jesimus." There were a few academic reasons that you closed the door, and from the inside, rather than behind you as you left. Her quarters held some measure of safety for you, as she warded with the paranoid focus of an escaped murderer, and therefore half as tightly as you did. You got better autopsies of her encounters with beasts than you did from your own, as Augustine was wont to explain significantly more to her than either he or Mercy did to you. But by the sown tongue, those fucking rooms, those candied white and gold striped rooms, those crystal chandeliered rooms with a bed as big as some of the penitential cells back home. You'd hated them from first sight, as instantaneously as Ianthe took a fancy to them. You despised the cobwebby, over-ornate furniture, with filigree on curlicue on flourish, the masses of embroidery thread, the hangings on everything, swathe of fabric atop another swathe of fabric, squashed down on a plush divan that rustled if you sat on it. And most upsettingly, the paintings. They were life-sized nudes in languorous attitudes, generally in oils, and all of the same two persons. They were enthusiastically executed, The duo posing held a variety of objects, both likely and unlikely. You had once been fool enough to recommend that Ianthe take them down, at which point she had rustled up another from the bathroom and hung it in pride of place above an overpainted dresser. It was not that you were a prude. It was simply that sitting in a room with those paintings was like having a long visit with someone who kept laughing at their own puns. But despite the violently awful nudes, the excess of latticework, Ianthe, you were a frequent visitor to her den. You took such a pitiful pleasure in Nona Jesimus, now that you had spent months being Harrowhark the First. As God said, you might be the ninth saint, but you could never be ninth again. Except when you closed Ianthe's door.
It's down to your want of ambidexterity, Tridentarius, you said, giving her the same sickly pleasure in nomenclature. It's not exactly mathematics. You are trying to fight with a sword in your wrong hand. I'm not even trying to fight with a sword. As I've been told tiresomely often, a half-cocked version of something is significantly worse than not being cocked at all.
Despite the fact that you had said, not being cocked at all, Ianthe only slurped angrily at her soup, making a sound like custard going down a flute.
Tell me to stop breathing, she said. I have, on multiple occasions, you said.
You won't understand. It's utterly instinctual. It doesn't matter if I try to fight from a distance. I'll flinch at something, and then Babs will kick in, and the arm won't work.
You cannot pass the blame onto your burnt-up soul. It's psychological.
Bullshit, she said with vehemence. Babs indicated a very bad day. She so rarely mentioned her cavalier.
Augustine is critical, I take it.
Augustine told me they might as well smother me along with you. You were only astonished that you had any ego left to bruise. She took another spoonful of soup and said, her whey-coloured face dissatisfied. He says the same thing you do. Psychological. Says I persist in being damaged for my own enjoyment. Still cold and very weary, you laid your sword at your feet and sat yourself down in a high-backed armchair with a frill around the bottom, done up in citrine stripes. Ianthe's rooms were undoubtedly more luxurious than yours, and more interestingly appointed, having belonged for centuries to a long-dead lictor, with time enough to come back every so often and furnish them to taste. But that long-dead lictor still seemed to sit in all the chairs and lie in the bed and shave by the water pump sink, and you were relieved that your rooms contained no ghosts but your own. You said,
there's nothing wrong with the arm.
It's not mine, Ianthe said vehemently.
Then cut it off.
So typically ninth.
Let your vaunted lictoral abilities kick in, you said. See if it regrows.
It won't, she said, taking you quite seriously. Teachers said lictors don't survive decapitation and that a lost limb would heal as a stump. And I know that if I try to make myself a new arm, I'll leave something out. If it's not perfect, it won't work, and I won't want it. The once Princess of Ida did not say this petulantly, but used the resigned, rather furrowed tones of someone mildly aggrieved by self-understanding. You suggested,
so get the Saint of Joy to do it. She can be relied upon for physiological perfection.
Oh, you crack up, said Ianthe, not lifting her eyes from her soup.
I personally would not let our eldest sister regrow any of my limbs, you said, but if perfection is what you desire...
Boo to that, said Ianthe. You grew bored.
Teacher, then.
He'd tell me how wonderful it would be to do it myself. We're not all teachers' sweet little darlings for whom he would do anything, she remarked. I have never been good at attracting indulgent fathers. You bristled, but had no adequate comeback. You were busy massaging your itching fingertips, which were still red and sore. The cellular degradation was subtle enough that you were healing one layer at a time to ensure you'd got everything. Not for you, the smooth stump of a regenerated lictor. You had to do everything yourself. Yet you also would not turn to God, who might heal you in one blinding, soul-nauseating instant, flensing you utterly from the bones upward, and who might also awkwardly pat you on the shoulder, or look at you with that solemn, half-troubled smile that you both craved and hated.
"Then, I do not know what to tell you," you remarked, "except that if you persist in asking for my opinion, at least pretend that you want it."
Ianthe pushed away her empty soup bowl and sat up, looking at you, stolen eyes narrowing with a sudden spurt of inspiration. Her paste blonde hair fell lankly over a face that should have been beautiful, and over shoulders that should have been exquisite, but only contributed to the general impression of a wax figure in a pink dolly dress. You had never been given the option to play with dolls, but given hindsight, you could not see yourself ever volunteering to have done so.
"But you might do it," she said softly.
You saw her looking at the necklet of bone that peeked out from the collar of your shirt, the top of your homebrew exoskeleton.
"You could do it, Harrowhag, and maybe I'd even let you, seeing as we're comrades in arms, seeing as we're intimates."
You stood up, more than a little repulsed, and your exoskeleton creaked as you bent to pick up the two-handed sword.
"I am not perfection yet when it comes to meat," you said. "I'm not saying I wouldn't be close, but you want something I can't give. Nor is it something I'm prepared to give. Being honest, I am mildly disgusted you asked. Is there soup left in the kitchen?"
"Oh, heaps," said Ianthe, who appeared not to have taken offence at your rejection. It was so impossible to tell with Ianthe.
"I made it. It's vile."
Were there less likely bedfellows now than you and she, the daughters of mystical Dreaber and self-regarding Ida? It was not a connection formed of any mutual admiration. If anything, the more you saw of Ianthe, the less likely you were to mistake her for likable. She made herself like an over-decorated cake, covered so thickly in icing and fondants and gums that it would take serious excavation to find any bread. As a necromancer, she was a genius, though you thought she relied too much on shortcuts and circumventions. She had an exceptionally fine mind. She was not afraid of rigour. She was also obsessed with what might lie beneath the river. And, though this was a touch hypocritical coming from you, but never mind, a fucking crank. But a crank who had attained lictorhood. A crank whom you are now obliged to call sister, though you thought it hurt her to call anyone sister much more than it hurt you. A crank whom a dead self had respected enough to include in the work. A crank who had found you distracted nearly to death, beside yourself, disgraced, having thrust your blade straight through a dead woman's sternum and simply said, "Wish you'd taken off her arms." Perhaps there were more likely bedfellows, but yours hadn't killed you yet.